From the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, well, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Our first guest this morning, Dr. Keith Knoll. He's the project scientist for NASA's Lucy mission. Lucy's a space probe on a 12-year journey to 8 different Jupiter Trojan asteroids. We look forward to our conversation with Dr. Knoll.
And our second guest this morning is Emily Willingham, who has written a new book called The Tailored Brain. Willingham writes about the touted tricks for brain optimization, including drugs, diet supplements, and cognitive training apps.
On October 16, 2021, NASA's space probe Lucy successfully launched from the Kennedy Space Center. Now, over the next 12 years, Lucy will visit 8 different asteroids in our solar system. Joining us now is Dr. Keith Knoll, who is the project scientist for NASA's Lucy mission. Dr. Knoll, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. It's a really exciting mission, and I thought maybe we'd start with this. If you could tell us what Lucy's objectives are and how they fit in with the overall NASA mission to understand asteroids.
Well, we're going to be the first mission to study a group of asteroids that probably a lot of people haven't heard about called the Trojan asteroids. And it's a little bit longer story why they're interesting. I hope we'll get into that. But every time we go to a place we've never been before, we find out something important and often are surprised. So that's really the shortest, most basic premise of the Lucy mission.
Right. And these gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, they're so much bigger than Earth and Mercury and Venus and Mars. Actually, Jupiter, I think, is 11 times the diameter of Earth. It's much larger. Because of their mass, are they holding on to these Trojan asteroids? Are they keeping them from us?
So Trojan asteroids is now a general term, but where they are in the solar system, if you can think of that map of the solar system you probably had on a placemat as a kid, looking down at the top with the planets going around in a regular order, the Trojans are going around the sun in the same orbit as Jupiter, but they're always either about 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter or 60 degrees behind. And the reason that they're stable there is that most of the time the big planets can give a little bit of a gravitational tug to other things in the solar system. You know, everything is orbiting the sun. That's the biggest, mass in the solar system. But these little perturbations can often destabilize orbits. But in these two special spots, the gravitational tugs from Jupiter actually create a little islands of stability. And so asteroids that find themselves there are trapped there. And that's why they're very interesting. They've been trapped there for 4 billion years. And how they got there and where they came from is one of the things we're really interested in figuring out with Lucy.
Mm. Yeah, let's get into that a little bit more, Dr. Knoll.
Sure.
Well, first of all, the Lucy mission is in part, I think the wording used was, you know, it's more of a budget mission compared to some of the bigger things NASA does. But in terms of, you know, the power that it... the punch that it packs in terms of what we find out about the formation of the solar system and even what it can tell us about life here on Earth is, you know, it's very well worth it. It's money well spent, shall we say.
Everything is relative, of course. space missions are not cheap, but you're right. This is a discovery mission, and those are sort of the most economical. Actually, NASA now is running some really economical tiny missions, but of the regular sort of planetary exploration missions, the discovery missions' goal is to try to get the most science that you can. And typically they stay closer in to the sun just because it's expensive and difficult to go further away from the sun. But that's one of the great things about Lucy, is that we are able to pack so much in to this mission, having so many different encounters with 8 asteroids total, 7 of them Trojans, in a single mission. And that's really powerful, because then you can start doing all these comparisons of the different objects that you see.
Right, right. One of the updates on the Lucy mission, and for those of us who are paying attention to the James Webb Space Telescope, we know that there's this big deal around solar arrays, and the James Webb, that was one of the first sort of announcements, is that its solar array was in place so it could propel itself with its energy from the sun. And that was something that you were looking at closely on the Lucy mission as well. Can you talk about the solar arrays?
Right. Well, we're going to be the furthest mission from the sun powered by solar arrays when we get out to the Trojan. So going a little bit further away than Jupiter, which currently has a solar-powered mission there. But that means that, you know, we need big solar arrays to generate electricity, which is the power that we use to power the spacecraft, keep it warm, operate the instruments. And right after launch is a critical maneuver. You launch with a battery to keep you alive for a couple hours. But the first critical thing that you have to do after you launch is open your solar arrays. And we did that. We always knew that that's a tricky thing. Anytime you have a deployment, you worry. Yeah. And that's what you were mentioning about JWST as well. One of the two arrays opened as planned. The other one opened most of the way, but it didn't get all the way to completion. That's a good news, bad news kind of story. The good news is that we're getting most of the power that we expected, and it's enough for us to be safe and healthy and charge our battery on the spacecraft. So as far as power goes, we're good. But we still want to latch the array if we can, because we always want to fly our spacecraft the way it was designed to be flown. We know that that's mechanically the stiffest and most secure configuration, but we're being very careful and taking our time. Engineers right now are building simulations in the lab so that we can really understand, because the one thing we don't want to do is do something in a hurry that makes things worse than they are. So that's where we're at, and I have a lot of confidence in our engineers. This is not the first challenge that Lucy has faced in development, and our engineering team has pulled us through before. I expect that they will do the same again this time around.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Dr. Keith Knoll. He's the project scientist for NASA's Lucy mission. Lucy is a space probe. It took off, it launched in October, and it's on a 12-year journey to 8 different Jupiter Trojan asteroids. Dr. Knoll, I guess if you're hanging out around Earth's orbit, only being 92, 93 million miles from the sun, if you have a satellite or a Hubble space telescope, you have a certain size of a solar array. But Lucy, for an example, man, that's going all the way out to Jupiter, and it's doing some slingshot maneuvers as well. So you need a larger solar array when you're further away from the sun, or you need a different type of solar array?
Well, we definitely need a larger one. If you were to see Lucy with the solar arrays deployed, the spacecraft looks tiny. It's about the size of an SUV. But end to end with the solar arrays deployed, it's more than 50 feet long. So, a fair-sized office building. And that's almost all solar arrays. To make something that big and launch it, you want to also make it very lightweight. So that's where all the effort goes into designing solar arrays to be used farther from the sun. And the Lucy solar arrays, were designed to do exactly that. They're very lightweight and they're big.
Yeah. And Lucy, again, is going to the two Trojan systems on either side of Jupiter. But then there's the Kuiper Belt, which is out by Neptune. Could you describe what the Kuiper Belt is, and also maybe tell us what a binary is?
Sure. Well, so the fun thing about being in planetary science over the last few decades has been that, you know, the solar system that we learned about as kids has really grown and changed a lot. And one of the things that we didn't know about, if you're as old as I am, was the Kuiper Belt. This is another belt of small bodies. So you can think of it as something like the main asteroid belt is the main thing that people think of when they think of asteroids. Those are between Mars and Jupiter. Then we have these Trojans that are trapped in these special spots in the orbit of Jupiter. But then if you go way out past the orbit of Neptune, there's another whole ring of small bodies out there. And in fact, as we started to discover more and more of those through the 1990s and early 2000s, that's what led to a reevaluation of where Pluto fits into the scheme of things. And it turns out that it fits much better into being one of the largest members of this group of small bodies at the edge of our solar system. And that's what led to the, you know, the sometimes controversial change of status for Pluto.
Poor Pluto.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've finally gotten over it, but when New Horizon did the flyby, those pictures were spectacular. I mean, that is the coolest looking planet, isn't it?
It is super cool. And, you know, I think it's a mistake to think that, you know, you can categorize something's interest by whatever, you know, category you stick it into. And so to me, this change of, you know, going from a planet to a dwarf planet doesn't mean anything. The big change was finding out how amazingly cool Pluto is. The other question you asked about is, what's a binary? And binaries are an interesting story, because that's another facet of Pluto. It turned out early on to have this really, really large moon. In fact, so large that the two bodies orbit around a point in space between them, rather than, you know, the small body orbiting around a point inside the big one. And that, to me, is, you know, sort of the boundary line of when things become binaries. But it turns out that in the Kuiper Belt, we see lots and lots of those. And in fact, it is beginning to look like that's the way that most of the small bodies, and when I say small bodies, I mean asteroids and comets, but mostly asteroids, form very early on in the solar system. And it turns out probably that shouldn't be a big surprise, because stars form the same way. They have a gravitational collapse, and because the cloud they form from is rotating, they have to put the angular momentum somewhere, and they do that by forming a pair of stars, binary star system. And it looks like the small planetesimals, the earliest things that condense in the solar system, do the same thing. And that gives us a way to make a bridge between the Trojans and the Kuiper Belt. We think they're close cousins. They probably started out in the very same part of the solar system. And interestingly, one of the Lucy targets is also one of these equal mass binaries. So, and that's the Patroclus-Menetius binary pair, which is the last target that Lucy will visit in 2033.
Hmm. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Keith Knoll. He's a project scientist for NASA's Lucy mission. So Lucy successfully launched from the Kennedy Space Center and will be out for 12 years. The launch was on October 16th. I'm forgetting now the name of the company. There's a private company, is that correct, that Lucy went up on for the launch?
We launched on, the way it works is that if you have a discovery mission like we do, NASA goes out and puts out bids for the launch vehicle. So they have a whole separate group that procures launch vehicles for missions. And we launched on an Atlas V 401 rocket. And that's a tried and true rocket that has been around for a long time. So that was how we went. But, you know, we, the Lucy mission, don't specify what the launch vehicle is going to be.
Yeah, and I guess that just struck me as interesting because I hadn't heard of that particular, company. And I know that there are so many privately held companies that are starting to do space exploration. You know, we've heard of, you know, the usuals, the ones that get the most, I guess, publicity, like SpaceX and I'm forgetting Jeff Bezos, Blue Origins. It just struck me as, wow, there's a lot going on out there in the world that probably the average layperson doesn't know about in terms of space exploration.
Yeah, no, it's a good model. And it's the United Launch Alliance that is the group that launched, made the provision of the Atlas V401 and launched for us. But you're right. I think it is. It's an exciting time with making it more than one way to get into orbit is a great thing.
Dr. Noel, you were part of the Space Telescope Science Institute for a number of years, I think 20 years, where you were a full astronomer, and you had a lot to do with Hubble. Hubble has just exceeded its mission. It's the most extraordinary thing responsible for getting people interested in space, I think. What are some of the images that you worked on? Did you work on the deep field studies?
No, I'm a planetary astronomer, so for my science, I mostly do solar system stuff. And with Hubble, what I did was search for these binaries that we were talking about, and we ended up finding still the majority of the known binaries in the Kuiper Belt were found in the programs that I ran. The other thing that I did when I was there, which was a lot of fun, is we ran this project called the Hubble Heritage Project. And so a lot of the images, maybe most of the images that you will see most often, came out of that project. And that was something I started because I realized I was working on the wide field camera team at the time. And I realized that, the way the pressure on the time for the science was so high that there was really no extra to do any more than the bare minimum that you needed for the science. And to a scientist, a fuzzy image can be super exciting because it tells you something about what it is you're trying to study. But for the public, that's a much harder translation. And it felt that we needed images that would translate more directly. So we went to the director at the time and asked for a little bit of telescope time to take, what you might term pretty pictures. We did it in a way that they would also be useful for science, but the big impact was that we were able to show the public the universe in a new way with Hubble, and that was a tremendous benefit for us, especially when there was the problems with the servicing missions and so on. The public support that came out was largely based on this relationship that they had with the mission by way of these images.
And the two clusters, the Trojans, there within those clusters of asteroids, there are lots of different types of asteroids, but there are three distinct ones, the dark red P, the D type, and I think the C type. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, so asteroids get categorized with this sort of alphabet soup, and it's a little bit like if you walked into your local coffee shop and look at the menu, there's, lattes and macchiatos and Americanos and so on. They all have the same basic ingredients, hot water, coffee, and maybe some milk added. And so asteroids work sort of the same way. There, the ingredients are things that we would call rocks, things that we would call ices, mostly water ice, but other things that can condense and freeze if you get cold enough. And then the differences are just the mix of those components, and then how much subsequent cooking has been done. How much heating has happened? Have you left the coffee pot on the heater for a couple hours? It's not the same as when you first brewed it. So, but we think we've sort of pushed to the limits of what we can do remotely from the Earth. And what we want to do is get up close. And what we're looking for is when you look at one of these objects, what do you see that might tell you why they look the way they do. Are they all the same everywhere, or are they, you know, mixtures of light and dark regions? Are the light regions at the bottom of big craters, or are they the tops of the tallest peaks? And that kind of data can help you unravel the sort of way that these things are put together. So that's what we hope to do with Lucy.
Well, you've already talked about how there's been no other space mission in history that has been launched to so many different destinations in different orbits around the sun. And I think it all ties back to, if you look at the graphic of the trajectory of Lucy's mission, it's really fascinating. John used the word slingshot. I think you used the word pretzel. But it's dispatches out to collect data around the Trojans and then come back. I assume that's coming back to get more solar energy and to then go off in a different trajectory to a different location. Could you explain a little bit about how that trajectory works?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I'll tell you a story. The first time I saw this diagram, which we call the pretzel diagram, I just, my jaw dropped and I gasped, you know, like in the movies. It's really an amazing diagram, and it presents all of the information about the mission in a single convenient chart. But it's also a little bit misleading, because this is a chart where, you know, the planet Jupiter doesn't move. So in physics talk, that's a non-inertial frame. So the trajectories look funny. In reality, what we're doing is just going in loops around the Earth. And each loop, we do a couple loops close in, and then finally we have loops big enough that make it out as far as the Trojans. And then, you know, just like throwing a ball up in the air, it has to come back down. But then we just loop around again. And when we come back in, we have close flybys with the Earth. Those are called Earth gravity assists. And they allow us to change the trajectory of the spacecraft a little bit without using a lot of fuel in the spacecraft. So that is a very useful feature for us. And it allows us to, you know, navigate and keep the weight of the spacecraft down a little bit. So it is a fascinating diagram. But the other way to get this, if you can get your hands on it, we have some movies out that show the trajectory. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, things are moving the way they really move in actual space.
Are there dates when the trajectory brings Lucy back near the Earth's orbit to be able to view it, if you happen to be out in the night sky and you're even an amateur astronomer?
That's a very interesting question. We come back three different times during the mission for close approaches. And the first one is almost a year after launch. So it's either the 16th or the 17th of October this year. And depending on the exact details of how the firings of the main engine go and how high we're going to fly past the Earth, some of which is still being decided, there will be places where you could go and look up and possibly see Lucy flying by. It's going to be 300 or 350 kilometers above the Earth, you know, roughly the same height as the International Space Station. And we may try it, but I can't tell you where to go to book your rooms just yet.
Darn.
You know, we are so fortunate on this planet to have Bruce, who can, you know, save us from any asteroids that were to hit us. But if he were not available, what's the latest on how to change the trajectory of an asteroid? They talk about nuclear devices. They talked about painting it white so that the sun reflects in a different way that would slightly nudge it. They talk about all sorts of different things. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is there was another mission that launched about a month after we did called DART. And it is designed to test a technology for redirecting, you know, a possible problem asteroid. And it's going to do this by just hitting a small asteroid with a high velocity impactor. So that's about as crude as you can think of when it comes to ways to redirect things. And it is also taking advantage of the fact that, you know, these even tiny asteroids have moons. So the target is the moon of an asteroid, a near-Earth asteroid named Didymos. And because it's got a small moon orbiting, the DART impactor is going to hit the moon. And then by watching the moon, we can see how much the orbit has changed. So that gives us a very, you know, relatively precise way to measure what the effect of the impact was. And that's important, an important test, because the thing we don't know is how hard versus spongy an asteroid might be. So you can imagine, you know, if it was really hard like a cue ball and you whacked it, you'll get a pretty good transfer of energy and or momentum, and it will be redirected. But if it's very spongy and you dissipate a lot of the impact energy, it might not be as effective in redirecting. So that's the purpose of this mission.
Asteroids are hard to find, and they don't reflect light very well. How is the sophistication of our monitoring system for being able to keep our eye on asteroids that may come close to us?
Well, we've gotten better and better over time, but, you know, you want to keep your eye out for these things. And there's another mission in development that will be designed to, you know, up the game a little bit in terms of hunting for even smaller objects that, you know, maybe wouldn't wipe out the entire Earth, but might cause, you know, severe damage to a local area. We all know in a recent past what happened with the Chelyabinsk impactor, and that was a pretty small object. That was probably only 15, 20 meters across. And so objects that small, first of all, there's a lot more of them, and they're harder to find and track. So it's going to be a continuing effort to keep these things under surveillance, just to rule out the, you know, it's unlikely, but it's also inevitable that eventually there'll be something that will be headed towards the Earth.
Dr. Keith Knoll is a project scientist for NASA's Lucy mission in Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland. We want to thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you continued success with your mission.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you both.
Okay, thank
Thanks,
you.
Our next guest is Emily Willingham, who has written a new book called The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. Emily writes that from pharmaceuticals and memory games to microdosing and intracranial stimulation, the human brain has come up with some clever ways to alter and potentially enhance its own function. Unfortunately, none of them reliably produces the desired results. She joins us to help us understand what does work and what doesn't work so well. Emily Willingham, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, it's really great to have you on. You know, there is so much in the way of, you know, enhancements for our cognitive function and brain exercises. And if you read some of the research, you can pretty quickly find out that some of these are just, I don't know, games and not necessarily something that's going to improve our cognitive function, but it could entertain us.
Yep, that's pretty much exactly right. They found when they look at lots of different things that if you do a certain thing a lot, like, for example, play Wordle these days, from what I hear, you get a lot better at doing that thing, but it doesn't necessarily translate into some kind of global improvement. So if you think it's fun, do it and have some fun.
Yeah, and yet, on the other hand, there's something that just applying some common sense to certain activities like, you know, constantly making change in your head or, you know, not forgetting to, you know, practice adding and subtracting, just simple things. It would seem like those kinds of things are exercising your muscle. And if you don't do that, just like any other part of your body, you may lose it.
Yeah, that's true. And what you're maintaining there is that specific skill. So you would have what the people in the field would call that's a near transfer. It's just right there at the skill. That's what you're improving or maintaining. But you don't see far transfer where, you know, an ability to make change kind of translates into a better memory or better performance on cognitive tests and things like that.
Emily, I really enjoyed what you said about IQ in the early part of the book, where you say, you know, people with brain boosters, they're promising to bump your IQ 3 points versus, and this is a quote from your book, a strategy that might help you become a kinder, more understanding, more empathetic person, which studies show now is really what helps you in business and in what helps you to be successful in life.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. When I came to this book, one of the things I wanted to do was to sort of interrogate and ask people to interrogate, you know, what is it that they really want to improve and why? And we do get promised a lot about this is going to make your brain so much better and da-da-da-da-da. But you don't see a lot of people offering, like, empathy or understanding other people in a pill. Yet, I think, as we probably have learned in the last few years, it's, you know, it's kind of an important skill to have, to be able to do that.
And your book's broken up into a number of chapters, chapter 3 and 4 on brain training cognitive boosters. But I love chapter 5, which is on social cognition. And it's just fascinating. How did you put that together?
I love that you love that chapter because I centered it on purpose. It's the center of the book. And I wanted to focus on that because we're among, you know, a selection of social species. We're kind of constructed around how we interact with each other. And like I said, I think we spend so much time focused on how can we make our individual brains better instead of kind of looking at ourselves as a collective. I think that's especially kind of a Western conceit, right? This individualist who goes forward and does something amazing. But in reality, we do amazing things together so much better.
Mm. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Emily Willingham. Her new book is The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship. It's a user's guide to feeling better and thinking smarter. You make some distinctions between cognition and intelligence. And then if we're relating that to Chapter 5 about social cognition, I've heard of emotional intelligence. How is that going to differ from social cognition?
I think it's kind of a part of it. I mean, emotional intelligence can be, well, cognition is thinking. So it's just kind of a broad, it just kind of means how are you at thinking about the thing, right? Or how well do you think in this context? And emotional intelligence means recognizing, or my construction of it, it means recognizing your own emotions, which not everybody is great at doing. So it's a practice, you know, to ask yourself, well, what is this emotion I'm having? You know, how appropriate does it feel to me? How does it feel for this situation? And also to identify that in other people as well. And then you can extend that to empathy, this concept of putting yourself in another person's shoes, kind of feeling what it's like to be that person in a given situation. And part of that process is emotion recognition.
Okay. I was wondering when I read a little bit in your book about a functional MRI, you know, we've learned so much in the last however long functional MRI has been around, but it seems like I've heard about it over the last decade, and it tells us so much about the way the brain works. And yet you have to sit in one of those little tubes, lie down in one of those little tubes, which some of us can talk ourselves into relaxing and not being stressed or claustrophobic, but so many can't and have a real problem with that. So how does that affect the outcome of a functional MRI?
That's a really good question. And somebody I interviewed for that chapter commented that, you know, one of the reasons they're doing this is they have somebody in there and they're doing something. They have a task that they're doing, and then they compare what they find on the imaging for that with what happens when the person's not doing the task. But when they're not doing that, like you say, they're lying inside a little tunnel, right? And they could be thinking about anything. You know, as this source told me, you know, he said they're college students, a lot of them, so you know what they're probably thinking about. And then if there's somebody who is claustrophobic, they may be developing some anxiety about being inside that too.
Yeah,
that whole thing's so interesting. And I know a little bit about the history of CT scans and CAT scans because I work for a company that made the S-130, which is a particular Eclipse processor that General Electric bought in. They bought tons of them back in 1974 and 1975 to put in the original CT scan. And since then, the software continues to improve, the hardware continues to improve, and you see all these different scans and the brains lighting up and the slices and dices of the brain and all that. How much of that is it scientists just saying, oh, the brain just lit up over here and this is going on, that's going on? How much is rhetoric and how much is actually good science?
That's another good question. And in the chapter where I discuss what, you know, this kind of imaging is, I note that it's been a process where people have had to figure out how to, you know, control for false positive readings and things like that. And then there's the story, you know, of the salmon that they put into the fMRIs, the dead salmon study. You probably maybe have heard of that. And, you know, it's a dead salmon. And because if they omit doing appropriate controls in these imaging studies, then you get situations where, for example, the dead salmon looks like it's participating in a task inside the MRI. So you do have to be extremely careful. I think that they've learned a lot about that over time.
Yeah. So when you look at these different cognitive aids that are being touted on the internet or articles are being written about, maybe you can tell us generally what's working and what's not working.
Well, what I found, and I did come to this kind of with almost no opinions, I was pretty agnostic about it, but what I found is that supplements don't seem to offer a whole lot, and more to the point about supplements is because they're kind of unregulated, we're not quite sure what's in them. So you don't know whether or not what it says on the tin is what's inside the capsule. And it can be nothing inside there, especially the active ingredient that's supposed to be there. But in some cases, it's active ingredients that aren't supposed to be there. So you've got to be super careful about that. What I did find can save you some money, and that is that moving around, physical activity, and spending time with people whom you love and trust and can share things, and also engaging in, you know, some kind of, you know, mindfulness practices, all are pretty useful for a lot of the ways that we use our brains.
So what you're saying is, you know, sitting around doing brain teasers, you know, Sudoku and all these different, what is the one that Tom Brady uses, Brain HQ, or may not be, I mean, we might be just as well off by going for a nice hike and breathing fresh air or having connectivity with, you know, people, whether it's even in the grocery store, having a little conversation with the cashier as you're going through the line.
You know, that's great. Yeah, things like that. I think that people, the brain games and things like that are fun. And like I said, people do experience improvement and the skills are required to play those games. But it's not quite the same as physical activity or engaging with another human. And I think maybe one of the reasons is those latter two things, when we do that, we offload a little bit. We offload what's called a cognitive burden. We release some things from our brains, and that makes space. Brains are real. They use resources. And if we're using them all up for things, we have no more space left. And physical activity and sharing things with other people can release some of that space.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much around, you know, for the aging brain, and people have been conditioned to think about how can we stave off the effects of, you know, Alzheimer's or anything like that as we age. And I'd love for you to kind of help set the record straight. My mom and I go back and forth about, she thinks that if she does jigsaw puzzles, she's going to keep her mind really sharp and she'll be able to stave off Alzheimer's. I love doing jigsaw puzzles, but for me, it's like a way, a meditation, like a way to kind of tune out the rest of the world. And I don't feel it like it's keeping my brain sharp. What would you say about that?
I would say that if you're doing something that is enjoyable for you, that's actually really helpful for your brain. And what you just described, where you kind of check out and just let your mind wander while you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, is a helpful way to clear space. You're kind of giving yourself that time to do that while you engage in a motor activity. And what I did the story for Scientific American, actually a Q&A with a person who wrote a book about physical activity. And he said that, and he and his group have hypothesized that physical activity actually gives you a longer healthy brain span, is what they call it, I think, or health span. And in part, that's because of a lot of the things that moving your blood around moves to your brain and helps kind of promote some flexibility there at the molecular level. So that's really kind of a big deal, physical activity, not just exercise, but, you know, just moving your body around, doing something.
And Emily, they say that if you do a certain activity or, you know, if it's exercise or preparing for Cool Science Radio or, you know, maybe a jigsaw puzzle, that you're creating some additional neurons in your brain. And I thought it was fascinating because I think a lot of people think that if you have more neurons, well, you're smarter. But what you write in the book is that having neurons endows a brain to have the capacity for cognition, but turning those capacities into actual abilities could take a lifetime.
The neuron count thing is funny because you would think, whoa, more neurons must mean more brain power. But what we see is developmentally, when you're born, you have a lot. And then through your earlier years, you go through pruning. Your brain kind of goes through and kind of nips and tucks here and there to develop what is kind of your average adult brain. And when I was just talking about physical activity, one of the things that happens is that you produce more of a factor that helps your neurons create more connections with other neurons. And they think that that might be kind of a buffer against, like, if you sustain some hits or some, not literal hits, but damages, you know, to your brain, that you'll have this buffer to work around them, like a bypass if you need to. So that's one utility of having more connections, is that you have a little bit of a buffer there.
So there are connections in a given brain, and you could be sitting next to somebody else that has connections in their own brain, and as you write, achieve some sort of synchronicity between the two of you, between the two people. And what I was thinking was, Lennon and McCartney used to sit in the Abbey Road studios, these cavernous studios, and they'd be in the middle of the studio on two folding chairs, just facing each other, both with acoustic guitars. And every time they got together, and they would get the synchronous thing going, I believe, they never had a sit-down session where they did not write one or two songs completely. Can you talk about how people can synchronize with other people?
Isn't that interesting? I did watch all of Get Back and watch them do that. I think the kids these days call this vibing, but they do have studies that show when people are working together like that and making that connection, that measurements of their brain waves, their actual waves, not just like, you know, bloody-da brain waves like from Coachella or something, but their actual measurements of their brain waves, they do seem to get in sync with each other. And you see that with students working together on projects in a classroom, between romantic partners. So there's this interesting resonance that happens. And, you know, Lennon and McCartney were almost like an emergent property of two things separately, not quite what they could be together in really surprising ways.
The sum of the parts.
Yeah. I guess that's why
I
enjoy Cool Science Radio so much. Maybe John and I have that synchronicity, that synchronous energy coming together to create something greater. What do you think?
Yeah, well,
I think maybe you two should do EEGs together and see. Yeah.
Well, I was listening to the start of the interview when Lynn was introducing you, and she asked the first question, and I was thinking, because you had a comment on this in your book, that you and Lynn were not interacting, but Lynn's brain and your brain were interacting together at that moment.
Right. I started the book saying, you know, what's interesting about humans, and I think this really does distinguish us from any other species, is that we can do this. We can interact with brains that are not in our immediate vicinity. We can travel through time, back in time, and see art and other things that other human brains have produced. And the three of us right now can sit here and have this connection among ourselves, even though we're, you know, hundreds of miles apart from each other. And I think that that's one of the distinctive features of being human, is our ability to do that.
Yeah. We have a little time remaining, and I wanted to bring up the subject of ketamine and other psychoactive drugs, mind-altering drugs. And I'm wondering, A, why you brought it into your book, and B, you know, how it's very popular these days, especially treating things like PTSD and depression.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be, from what I've read, very effective, but why did you include it?
I wanted to include things that were kind of capturing what's out there in the zeitgeist right now, and where the research is pretty recent, and things that I think people are curious about. And I see a lot of people talking about psychedelics. There are institutes being set up to write about psychedelics. There are entire books about psychedelics. And so I wanted to go into the literature, meaning the scientific research, and see, you know, what does the evidence say right now? And what I found is that in some cases, there's some benefit for, like you just mentioned, people who have PTSD. So maybe some stress or anxiety benefit, and then benefit for people who have mood-related conditions like depression. And so there is some promise there, it looks like. But I feel like it's still early days, especially for controlled randomized trials, which would be the most stringent.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other claims that you've seen with this, in this area of drug usage that you question?
I question everything, so
yeah,
that would just be
healthy.
Kind of just an ongoing process.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, what I find is that I think most things right now are kind of overpromised, and that it's great to kind of wait and see where the evidence really leads, especially when they get into doing randomized trials. But some people don't have time to wait. They need help right now, and they're going to go seek it, which is one reason I wanted to include these things in this book, so there were some evidence they could parse out and make that decision if they need to make it immediately.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Emily Willingham. She's written The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. One of the other examples that I thought was fascinating about what you discussed in your book that doesn't necessarily work is all these little things for melancholy. Well, if you take omega-3 and the fish comes from North Atlantic and it's ice-cold fish, then the omega-3 is going to help your melancholy. If you take vitamin D or D3, whoa, you're going to be able to, come out of this. Why is there no attention to omega-3, and then it is the wonder drug, it's the wonder supplement that's going to cure everything, and then it kind of disappears, and then in the next decade it's, well, vitamin E, it is the wonder supplement.
The bottom line there is that observational studies versus randomized controlled trials. And so, and I think in both cases that you just mentioned, they do these studies that are called observational studies, where they just kind of take people who have a history of taking the thing, and then people who don't, and they compare them without any controls, and there's no placebo that they give some, you know, group of people in the study. And so those studies made it look like, yes, look at all these amazing things omega-3 can do, or vitamin D or vitamin E. But when you take it to the kind of stricter form of study design and you really select people who are quite similar, you give some of them the drug or the intervention and some of them placebo, and then you look at what happens, you don't see the effects, which is another reason to kind of wait, if you can, for studies like that.
Yeah.
And in fairness, I believe you point out in the book that omega-3 can help, not necessarily will help, but can help certain epileptic seizures. Is that true?
It's gosh, you know, when it comes to something that's really clinical like that, I would hesitate to give any kind of an endorsement. And what I really saw in the book that would people use for epilepsy is the keto, a very specific prescribed keto diet that has been used for people who have seizures that will not stop. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that they use for that.
Okay, so that's where the keto figures into this conversation.
Yeah, I'm gonna go home and get some carbohydrates.
Well, the book is really quite fascinating. It's called The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. Our guest is Emily Willingham. Emily, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks to both of you for having me. That was fun.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. You can always catch our archived shows at kpcw.org. Also, wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW Cool Science Radio.